You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Guardian U.S. published leaked court documents from Wisconsin's John Doe investigation earlier this week. We'll talk about that and other news in our weekly roundup with Rob Mentzer. First, we're taking a look at the correctional system in Milwaukee. Autopsy results for an inmate who had died at the Milwaukee County Jail were released yesterday by the County Medical Examiner's Office. The cause of his death, dehydration, it was ruled as a homicide. 38-year-old Terrell Thomas was found dead in his cell on April 24th, just 9 days after he was arrested for shooting a man and firing two other shots in the Pottawatomie Casino. According to earlier reports from the Journal Sentinel, inmates near his cell said that his water access had been shut off. Joining me now is Kara Lombardo. She's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been covering the story. Kara, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why did the medical examiner decide to qualify this as a homicide?
Well, what that qualification means, actually, it does not necessarily mean that someone committed a crime or that someone will be charged with a crime. It means that the death took place at the hands of another person. So because likely someone shut off his water or was not giving him adequate water, he died of dehydration.
Now, can you talk through the story and the sequence of events that led to his death?
Sure. So Terrell Thomas, as we know, was arrested at Pottawatomie Casino. He had been acting strange for several days. His family and friends all said that. And, of course, the other patrons in the casino who were there at the time said that he had been screaming strange things. He ended up firing two shots into the air there, and he was arrested. He was brought to the county jail where he was placed in a normal cell. He was acting so erratically that they eventually moved him a few days in into the segregation unit. And there is where nearby inmates say that they saw Terrell Thomas's water access in his cell was shut off from the first day that he got to the segregation unit. And when one of them asked a correctional officer about it, this inmate said he was told that because Terrell had been acting so erratically, they needed to shut off his water so that he wouldn't make a mess in his cell.
And then over the next few days, it sounds like his condition got worse and worse. Is that right? Kara, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. What happened after that?
Yes, then over the next few days, actually, at least two nearby inmates were urging the correctional officers to give Thomas water. Thomas was very out of it. He was, at this point, had no clothes on, was lying in his cell most of the day, or just screaming nonsensical statements. And
I think we've lost Kara Lombardo there. Her line just cut out. We will check in with her. A reminder that we are talking to reporter Kara Lombardo. She's a reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been covering the story of a man who died at the Milwaukee County Jail, ruled as a homicide by a medical examiner. That does not mean anybody will be at fault, but we'll pick her up in just a moment to get the rest of that story. Coming up, by the way, in just a few on Central Time, we'll talk to Larry Kudlow. He's got a new book out on tax policy in the United States, saying there's a direct line from John F. Kennedy to Ronald Reagan and that we can learn something in the modern day from what they had in common. We've got Kara Lombardo back with us. Kara, are you there?
Hi, thanks.
Okay, yeah, we just lost your line there. Well, I wanted to get to the investigation now. What happens in a case like this where somebody dies in custody at the Milwaukee County Jail?
Yeah, well, actually, there's a 2014 law here in Wisconsin that requires an outside agency to review an in-custody death. So if a death happened in the custody of the Milwaukee Police Department, for example, perhaps the Sheriff's Department would be responsible for reviewing it. Well, that law doesn't technically apply to the Sheriff's Department, which is where this death took place. The district attorney in Milwaukee County decided to order an outside investigation anyway. So the police department is currently conducting an investigation. They expect to finish that soon. And then the district attorney will review that, and they'll make a decision about what to do with what's in the investigation.
As I understand it, the police had not talked to some of the inmates that you had talked to until the Journal Sentinel had reported on their testimony or what they had to say about it.
That's correct. The family of Terrell Thomas had been hearing through the grapevine that some inmates
thought that his water being shut off may have caused his death. So we got in touch with those inmates. We published their accounts saying, this is what people are saying, but we have not been able to get answers to these questions from the sheriff's department. And after publishing those accounts, within a week, within just a few days, I went back to visit one of the inmates, and he told me that investigators had just been there to visit him earlier that morning. So then his interview and a few other inmates were interviewed as part of the police department's investigation.
And you talked to members of Thomas's family. They were wondering why there hadn't been some more mental health evaluation, maybe even instead of in a jail, confinement in a mental health institution of some sort. What did they say about that?
That's right. Well, Thomas had a history of mental health issues. His family had known that he had spent time in the mental health complex in Milwaukee County in the past. And his mom told me that that had always been helpful. He often went through periods where he wasn't thinking clearly, and he was saying these strange things that he was saying at the time, around the time of his death. And his mom said with proper mental health treatment, he was usually able to come out of those periods. She is concerned that if he had been sent elsewhere or if he had gotten faster medical attention, this could have all been avoided.
Now, the Journal Sentinel had looked at deaths in police custody of various sorts a while back and had found over a 5-year period ending in 2012, 18 in custody deaths. I think 10 of them were in Milwaukee County jails. Can you talk about what kind of things had happened there?
Yeah, 10 of them were in the custody of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. And there was at least one where the inmate's water had been cut off. So this is obviously something that does happen. I've spoken to some lawyers who have represented families in cases like this. While this, you know, shouldn't happen frequently, it is unfortunately a technique that is sometimes used to discipline inmates, cutting off water access for a period of time. This a similar situation happened at least once before, but the autopsy in that case actually was the cause of death ended up being complications from a psychotic disorder. So this is a slightly different case here.
Has the county sheriff's office, Sheriff Clark, commented publicly on this?
His office released a very brief statement yesterday, simply saying they do not plan to make any comments until all investigations are officially closed, because, again, we're still waiting even for the official police department's investigation to be closed, and until all civil suits that could arise from this are complete. So that would be if the family of Terrell Thomas chooses to file a civil suit against the sheriff's office. That could obviously be, you know, several months or years from now that would be filed and complete. So we're hoping for comment before that, but that is what the statement that was released yesterday says.
And is there a timeline for the police investigation of what happened there?
No, it's been ongoing for several months, and as you know, it was expanded, you know, midsummer, so we still don't have any idea of when that'll be completed.
And I assume guards, officers with the Sheriff's Department haven't publicly commented on this?
That's correct.
So what's your next step in investigating this? You've been following this story for a while. What are you looking to find out next?
Well, you know, right now the family and obviously other types of advocates are concerned that policies may not be in place to protect current and future inmates. We don't know if this is something that happens frequently. We still don't really have the details of what exactly took place during his 9 days in the jail. And so I think there will be a push to get some of those details.
And you mentioned the possibility of a civil lawsuit possibly by Thomas's family. Is there any indication from them that they're planning on that, or is that still something that is down the road?
At this point, they're not ruling it out. It's always a possibility, because even if criminal charges are, whether criminal charges are filed by the district attorney's office or not, a civil suit is always a possibility for the family of someone like this.
And to return to the point that the medical examiner had said this is a homicide, that doesn't mean that any criminal charges would necessarily be filed by the DA. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. In fact, that term simply means somebody else's action or lack of action was the main underlying factor in this death. So another example of a homicide where a charge is not always filed is something like a police shooting that was done in self-defense.
Kara, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Carol Lombardo. She talked to us about her report from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel on an inmate whose death at the Milwaukee County Jail was caused by dehydration and ruled a homicide by a medical examiner there. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, September is National Honey Month, so for this Food Friday, we're talking about using honey in our sweet and our savory recipes. First, as we get closer and closer to the presidential election, one issue that keeps rising to the top is the economy. While the country has shown slow and steady economic progress since the Great Recession, many Americans are still either out of work or struggling with stagnating wages, and voters want to know what their candidate of choice will do in order to boost that recovery. Our next guest says if you look back 20 or 30 years, you'd see a rosier time for the economy in America. They chalk the success up to a position that two very different presidents, John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan, they say championed, tax cuts across the board. It's an approach they say could work again today, and a return to free market economic principles and limited government is what the economy needs now. Lawrence Kudlow joins us now. Larry is a senior contributor to CNBC. He's also a radio host and columnist. He's the co-author of the new book, JFK and the Reagan Revolution, A Secret History of American Prosperity. He talked to Veronica Rickert earlier today.
Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, today we think of President Ronald Reagan as the pioneering tax cutter, but you say that John F. Kennedy was actually the original pioneer in this approach, and he paved the way for Ronald Reagan to follow suit later on. So how did JFK become who you see as the original supply-side economics guy?
Well, thank you. You do have the story right. I appreciate that. You know, Kennedy knew, or Kennedy believed, that after a very close win over Richard Nixon in 1960, and a lot of it was about the lousy economy during the Eisenhower years, and Kennedy had a campaign pledge of 5% economic growth per year, and he figured if he didn't get that, he wouldn't be reelected in 64. So that was his primary goal, though he never told us how. And then, to make a long story short, in 1961, he turned to his well-known liberal academic economists on his Council of Economic Advisors, people like Walter Heller and Paul Samuelson and James Tobin, and they gave him a big government spending package, right? And so they put that into place in 61, and it didn't work. In fact, it looked like the economy was petering out again. And then comes the hero of the book, or the sub-hero after Kennedy, and that's a Republican named Douglas Dillon, who was Kennedy's Treasury Secretary. Kennedy, by the way, had three Republicans in top jobs in his cabinet. Anyway, Dillon created a much different idea. Dillon said, we've got to lower tax rates across the board. Those days it was 91% top rate, if you could believe that. And that's what's holding back the economy, and that's what's holding back initiative, and we need new incentives. And, you know, he went back and forth with Kennedy, and they basically came up with a plan that would lower the tax rate from 91 to 65, and that would be accompanied by closing a lot of the so-called loopholes in the tax code. And a guy named Stanley Suri, a famous tax lawyer from Harvard, was the assistant Treasury Secretary for tax policy. And they sold it to JFK. He was looking for something that would get the economy going again, and they sold it. And he went with it. He fought hard for it and gave some great speeches that we have in our book. This was 20 years before Reagan. So guess what? It worked. You know, after his tragic assassination, the economy really boomed. Actually, it had started in 62 when they had an investment tax cut. And then it kept going, really, I think for 8 years, 5% economic growth. So he really was the first so-called supply-sider, which means cutting marginal tax rates, so you keep more of the extra dollar you earn.
Well, as you say, that top marginal tax rate when JFK came into office, it was 91%, and that's way up there. So are we making too much of the fact that Kennedy wanted to lower a rate when the rate was 91%?
Well, you know, in those days, that was a big deal because that rate had been put into place in the 1930s. No one did anything about it. 40s, 50s, Eisenhower wouldn't cut tax rates. So what Kennedy did was a fairly radical thing. You know, we hadn't had tax rates cutting since, I guess, the 1920s. So, you know, we call JFK the first supply cider, at least after World War II or after the Great Depression. And, you know, what happens later is after the terrible economy of the 1970s with high inflation and high unemployment, Ronald Reagan is running for president. And one of his top advisors, a congressman, late Jack Kemp, a friend of mine, my mentor, and he said, let's just use the Kennedy tax cuts to grow the economy and straighten things out. And Kemp sold it to Reagan. And so Reagan ran on a 30% tax cut, which was what Kennedy ran on. And that would take the top rate down from 70% where it landed to 50%. And then, as you know, later on, there was bipartisan tax reform that took the rate down to 28%. So, you know, Reagan was devoted to it. But really, he said in many of his speeches, this is a key point, in many of his speeches, Reagan cited JFK, gave him full credit. And I think the tragedy here, to be honest with you, is, you know, we need today, we've had a really stagnant economy for 15 years. Republicans, Democrats haven't been able to fix it. My opinion is we need to cut taxes again. We need to cut taxes again, and we need a bipartisan tax cut, which is what Kennedy did in 62, 3, and what Reagan did in 81 and 86. A bipartisan, there's no reason why Democrats can't be a tax-cutting party. But unfortunately, today's Democratic Party has kind of read JFK's tax-cutting legacy out of history. They don't refer to it, and they want to raise taxes, and I think that's really too bad.
We're talking to Larry Kudlow right now, senior contributor to CNBC. He's also a radio host and a columnist and co-author of the new book, JFK and the Reagan Revolution, A Secret History of American Prosperity. And Larry, you're saying what we need to do is what Reagan and JFK did and cut these taxes again to get the economy moving. But is it fair to compare the economies of the 1960s or the 80s and 90s to the economies today? Isn't it a different beast?
No. I mean, look, growth is growth. And incentives are incentives. So if you're rewarded by harder work or greater investment or more risk-taking or starting a new business, you know, let's see the next new Google or the next new Apple, lower tax rates have always had a very positive impact on the economy. And I think today, by the way, probably more important than the personal tax rate is the corporate tax rate, the business tax rate, which federal and state is 40% or more. We are, I guess we're the highest in the developed world. We are not competitive. Our own companies have moved offshore, taken their cash with them. Other foreign companies don't want to invest here. And I think that's probably done the most damage to our economy, to wages, to productivity. So, yeah, I think it would be just as applicable today, but it's more emphasis, I would say, on the business tax rates than perhaps the personal tax rates, although I myself am a flat tax guy. You know, I'd probably cut the personal rate to 20% and have no deductions whatsoever. But in any event, whatever I want, I think if you want higher wages, American workers haven't had a wage increase basically since the year 2000. The best way to do it is slash business tax rates. You get more investment, more productivity, more jobs, better pay.
And we are looking at rising rates of income inequality in the United States and around the world. You think cutting, especially the corporate tax rate, is the way to change that?
Well, not necessarily. I don't believe that inequality is the biggest issue. I think growth, or the lack of growth, is the biggest issue worldwide. In fact, some economists, some academics have done work on this that shows the more successful the economy is, the more inequality there is. Other economists have done work that says inequality, you know, it's out there, but it doesn't have any real impact on growth. I mean, look, I think this country has, unfortunately, stagnant wages and growing poverty. And with respect to poverty in particular, economic growth will solve a lot of that. Not all of it, mind you. I mean, there are education reform issues and family breakup issues and so forth. But if you're growing at 1 to 2, don't expect any amelioration in the poverty rate. If you're growing at 4 to 5, which was the Kennedy growth rate and the Reagan growth rate and the Clinton growth rate, 80s and 90s, you run at 4 to 5, I guarantee you more jobs will be created and poverty will be diminished. So give me growth anytime.
Now, we're in the thick of election season heading into the home stretch. And, of course, whoever takes the White House is going to get to put into place the policies that will affect the economy and the way the economy turns. So with that in mind, who do you think has the best plans to help the economy and lift everybody's boat?
At the moment, Donald Trump is the big pro-growth tax-cutting guy. He just gave a speech yesterday at the New York Economics Club, cutting personal rates, really slashing business rates to 15% from 40. That's for both large and small companies. Now, Trump is the growth candidate, and although he's an imperfect candidate, and I understand some of the issues around him, on the economy, frankly, he's got the best plan, which resembles JFK and Reagan's approach. So if he were elected, I think you'll see tax reform right away.
Larry, we leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Larry Kudlow, co-author of the new book, JFK and the Reagan Revolution, A Secret History of American Prosperity. He talked to Veronica Rickert earlier today. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're talking about cooking sweet and savory dishes with honey. It is National Honey Month, so we'll get some great recipes. It's not just for tea anymore, apparently. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, The Guardian U.S. published leaked court documents from Wisconsin's John Doe investigation earlier this week. We'll talk about this and other news in our weekly Wisconsin Roundup with Rob Mentzer. First, September is a month dedicated to something you probably have sitting in your kitchen, honey. And if you just use that honey in your tea, our guest says there's a whole lot more you can do with it. Joining us now is Zeke Freeman. He calls himself a recovering chef, and he's the founder and CEO of the honey company Bee. That's B-E-E, raw. Zeke, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I say the word honey, but looking around at some of your recipes and things like that, just one word doesn't seem to do it. There's a lot of variety, it sounds like, in honey. Can you talk about where that variety comes from and how much difference it makes?
Yeah, you nailed the word there, variety. And so what we call the types of honeys that we do are varietal honeys. And that means that our honeys come from a specific floral source. And what happens is our beekeepers, they take their bees and they place them in a buckwheat field or an orange grove or a wild raspberry patch. And the bees collect the nectar from that specific floral source and they make honey from it. And that changes everything, the color, the texture, and obviously the flavor of the honey.
Yeah,
we don't do anything. We leave it raw, completely unprocessed, and you get just an enormous difference from what you would find in your grocery store in the honey bear.
Yeah, you make a big case for raw honey. Why is that? Why does that make so much difference if it's not pasteurized?
Sure. So being a recovering chef, it's all about flavor, right? It's all about flavor for us. So while there are health benefits to their to raw honey, the enzymes are intact, all of that good stuff. The really what matters to me is that the flavor stays intact. So when the honey is heated and processed and super filtered, you lose a lot of the texture and flavor qualities that raw honey presents.
And what's the difference side by side between that container of honey that I might have had sitting in on my shelf for a year and some really good fresh varietal honeys?
Yeah, I think what you're going to see is one, that honey on your shelf is probably still liquid, which means that all of the pollen and the good stuff has been filtered out of it, and a lot of that's where the flavor is present. And you're going to see that the raw honey may begin to crystallize, you know, over a couple of days or a week, and that crystallization actually adds a lot of interesting texture and flavor and melts in your mouth more slowly and gives you a lot more nuance to the honey.
Well, let's talk about cooking with honey. Again, I am pretty limited in my daily uses of honey. Honestly, I don't really think of it as part of my cooking palate. Make the case that I should start thinking of it that way.
You know, the way I think about it is you know, I usually have four or five honeys in my pantry and treat them the same as I treat different spices in my pantry. You know, our goal is to take people past tea and toast. So, you know, I certainly do a ton of savory recipes with honey. We're going to talk about a couple of chicken wing recipes that I do this time of year. I have this amazing butternut squash recipe, but I also do fun things like cocktails and cheese pairings. And I'm sure your Wisconsin folks are going to love about hearing about the cheese pairings.
Let's go right there. Yeah, we are in Wisconsin. Honey and cheese is a thing I really wouldn't have thought of pairing. I think I've heard of it happening on a plate at you know, hip restaurants and things like that. How do we go about pairing honey with cheese?
So the way we go about it is we like to, first of all, you can't go wrong. If you choose a honey and a cheese, you know, it's probably going to be pretty good. We get a little nerdy about it. So we break up the different styles of cheese and pair them with specific honeys. So for example, like Alpine cheese, like Gruyere, we really like with our Meadow Foam honey. And Meadow Foam, is this honey that comes from Oregon and has these really like cotton candy creme brulee notes that pair really well with like the nuttiness and sweetness of your Alpine style cheeses. On the contrary, our buckwheat honey, which is this giant, big, kind of molassesy, barnyardy honey that's dark, dark, dark brown, almost black, goes fantastically with your fresh cheeses like ricotta or fresh goat cheese or even yogurt.
Big fan of aged cheddars in my house, good sharp cheddar. What kind of honey goes well with that?
I like orange blossom with that. I find that the floral citrus notes really kind of pair nicely with cheddars.
So it sounds, we can really nerd out with honey. It sounds like we could treat honey like wine or like people are getting with beer if we want to.
Unquestionably. And, you know, certainly when we talk about it, we often talk about it in the same way as we talk about wine. We actually have flights of honey in the way that you would have a flight of wine.
We are getting nerdy with honey. We're cooking with honey on this edition of Food Friday. Zeke Freeman is with us, founder and CEO of the honey company Bee Raw, and he's been a chef himself over the years. So, Zeke, let's get into some of the recipes and the cooking you mentioned. You mentioned those chicken wings, and I saw you had three different sauces. So you make up the wings, and you've got three different honey-based sauces to serve with them. Talk us through some of those sauces.
Yeah, so this is really kind of a fun way to do your football party or any party, you know, this time of year is you start your chicken wings in the oven, you split them up into three separate trays, you get them going, and you cook them for about 40 minutes. And in the meantime, I have three different sauces that I do. I do a sriracha honey ginger glaze. I do more of your traditional buffalo wing glaze, and then more of a soy Asian ginger glaze. And so you get these multiple different flavors, and you know it's just super easy preparation. So as your chicken wings are roasting, you create these three different sauces. You split each of them in half, and then 40 minutes goes by. You toss each one of the sheet pans in half the sauce. You toss them back in the oven for another 20 minutes. They come out and they're ready to go. And then you have the rest of the sauce for dipping.
Sounds great. And I guess it's not that surprising. I think of barbecue sauces sometimes will have honey in them. So that's sure. I guess, a mental starting point here.
Absolutely.
And then we've got a recipe. This one is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And we've been thinking about it for a little bit now. A candied honey bacon. Talk us through
Sounds
that.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, this one, you know, is fun by itself as a snack or, you know, dunked in your Bloody Mary. But it's also really great for, like, crumbling up into a salad.
Ooh,
is
yeah.
really interesting. And I've also ground it up a little bit and tossed it into popcorn, which is out of sight. So, you know, this is really easy. You know, it's a little bit of Dijon mustard, some cayenne pepper, some orange blossom honey. You mix those items together. You toss a pound of bacon into it, and then you put them in an oven, a 350-degree oven, you know, for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. And the real key to this recipe is letting them bake long enough that they get crispy. You have to really let them get dark, probably darker than you might think, because if you don't, it can have that kind of soggy-ish, like, you know, chewy-ish, as opposed to like a really nice crispy bite. But yeah, a lot of fun to garnish things with. You can really, you know, play around with it a bit.
Is that long enough and hot enough for the honey to caramelize a little bit on the bacon, or does it just kind of soak in?
No, it definitely, the whole thing caramelizes. It definitely gets really hot, and that's the key to making sure you leave it in long enough so the thing's really darken up, really dark brown.
That sounds fantastic. Again, that one for the candied honey bacon is available. You can find a link to Zeke's recipe there on the Central Time Facebook page. And you mentioned butternut squash. And Zeke, I'm really excited because we're coming up on winter squash season here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
What can we do with honey? What kind of honeys go well with a butternut squash?
So for this recipe, I really like buckwheat honey, and I mentioned buckwheat before, and buckwheat's, you know, we call it the Guinness of honey because it really has this dark brown black color and this big, big flavor that's really earthy. So it really kind of plays, it's probably while it's sweet, it's our most savory honey. So it really plays well with other sweet things and actually can bring an earthy characteristic to a dish. So in this case, there's actually two ways that I like to do it. You can do it where you just half the butternut squash, seed it, and then brush the butternut squash with the honey, roast it for a little while, brush a little bit more on, roast it for a little while. And that's probably the easy, most family-friendly way to do it. Additionally, you can slice it up into kind of quarter, half-inch pieces and toss the squash in the honey and then sauté it for, you know, 5-7 minutes, and you get this just really coated squash dish that really holds together and has this nice kind of earthy brown color. Really beautiful.
I like the sounds of that second way. So we're just tossing it and then olive oil or something to marinate or to saute in?
No, just the honey.
Just the honey.
The honey. Yeah, super, super simple.
Is that going to stick to my pan?
It will stick to your pan, but the moisture of the butternut squash releases as you're cooking. You know, you're keeping this over kind of a low medium heat, and so the goal is for the moisture from the butternut squash to release as you're cooking this, and you know, so at the end you get more of a glaze that will stick but shouldn't burn.
That sounds fantastic.
And at the end of it, towards the end, you do a little grated orange zest in there, and it just kind of creates this little pop of freshness.
That sounds great and pretty easy. It is National Honey Month. We're talking to Zeke Freeman. He is founder and CEO of the company Bee Raw. We are talking about cooking with honey, not just sweet stuff, savory stuff too, as we've been hearing. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite foods to pair with honey? Do you use honey as a sweetener for desserts or as a glaze in some of your savory recipes? Do you try different kinds of honey? Are you a honey connoisseur or do you make your own honey? This is Wisconsin. These things happen. Tell us what types of honey you like using and get some advice, too, from Zeke. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post and find a recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with Zeke Freeman, founder and CEO of the honey company Bee Raw, and we're talking about cooking with honey. I've learned a ton already, a lot of things I want to try. The candied honey bacon recipe on our Central Time Facebook page. mixing up some honey with squash. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Tell us how you cook with honey, what types of honey you like to use. Do you mix honey in with your fall recipes? Have you made honey with squash? Or do you want some advice from Zeke? He's got a zillion recipes up on his website. He can probably answer your honey-related cooking questions. Again, call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Zeke, before we go to our callers, let's talk a little bit about drinking our honey. You've got a couple cocktail ideas using honey.
Oh yeah. That's probably my biggest passion is making cocktails. I mean, personally, I'm a fan of a cocktail. But you know, getting people to use honey in cocktails is pretty intriguing because people just, you know, most people like cocktails. So it's like, if you take your standard cocktail, like a margarita, and you swap out what is normally agave or sugar or, you know, sour mix and add honey, you get a really spectacular, you know, drink. So, you know, my recipe is, you know, 2 ounces of tequila, 2 ounces of, you know, orange blossom, honey, and, you know, one part of fresh lime juice. You know, all those fresh ingredients are so important. You mix it up, you know, and it's just like the simplest, cleanest drink you've had. So I'm a big fan. Whether it's a margarita or a caipirinha or, you know, a mojito, honey makes it better.
Zeke, we got to get you out here to host a party for some time. Those chicken wings with the sauces, these cocktails. This sounds great. Let's go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Franklin. Mike, hi.
Hi, I just had a quick question about like chocolate chip cookies or a typical recipe you would use sugar in. Is there a ratio that you can apply to replace the sugar with honey?
There is. Usually you use about 2/3 less honey than sugar. Honey is a bit sweeter. And then you have to consider that honey is a liquid, so sometimes you have to up the amount of flour that you use as well.
Interesting. Mike, thanks for that call. Is there a good type of honey for your basic old-fashioned chocolate chip cookie that you'd recommend, Zeke?
Yeah, you know, we actually have a Wisconsin cranberry honey, which I'm a big fan of and I think is, you know, really fantastic in baking.
That sounds great. Thanks for that call, Mike. We'll go next to Lane in Wind Lake. Lane, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Zeke, I just wanted to ask Zeke, my wife's uncle sells honey in New Berlin, and he actually has given me some with actually the honeycomb part of it, and I was wondering if Zeke could explain how to actually eat the honeycomb itself.
You know, the honeycomb is pretty fantastic. You know, it's kind of like, I think of it kind of like chewing gum. You know, you cut off a corner of it, you chew on it until, you know, all the honey is gone, and then you spit out, you know, what's left. It's pretty simple and really enjoyable because there's nothing more fresh than honey in the comb.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, it can't get much fresher than that. Zeke, does that taste even better still than a raw honey out of a jar?
Yeah, there's something pretty special about it that way.
That's great. Well, Lane, I hope that helps you next time the uncle gives you a honeycomb. I'll go next to AJ in Madison. AJ, hi.
Hello there. I have a comment and also a question here. Just how I use honey myself in the house. My favorite is buckwheat. And I have it around almost always. And I typically use it to spice up really healthy snacks. So I'll mix it into anything from peanut butter to put on my pretzels, into my yogurt or my Greek yogurt. And even just adding it into a smoothie for a little bit more flavor. That's generally how I like to mix it up. Or even into some like mustard, make your own little honey mustard and top different vegetables and things like that with there. So that's kind of how I use it, even if it's not cooking. It's just very simple to use. You can add it to anything. My question is along the lines of the craft beer scene. Since we are here in Wisconsin, you know, that's kind of a big part of our lives. I did a little homebrew once that included fresh honey. But do you have more comment? Do you know how that's being used, if there are local brewers or crafts around the country that are doing that more?
Honey in our beer, so, Zeke, yeah.
I know. Honey in your beer, mead, all these things, they're really, really popular, both of those things. It's something that I haven't done any myself, But we know a lot of people who do, and we sell honey to a number of mead makers and a few beer makers, and they find that even those varietal honeys can really make a significant difference in their brew.
Thanks a lot for that call, AJ. We're talking to Zeke Freeman. He is a recovering chef. He's founder and CEO of the honey company Bee Raw. We're talking about cooking with honey, making cocktails with honey, grilling with honey. Very, very versatile stuff and a lot of variety out there, too. We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Deborah is on the line in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Hello. I wanted to know if you have any ideas for honey mustard. And also, I have a cousin who's actually a rocket scientist. I mean, literally, he is a genius. But he cooked when I was living there for a while at his apartment in New Jersey for a while, peanut butter chicken. And I thought, and I recently bought peanut butter with honey in it. And it was awesome. And I thought, you don't have to have the jelly, just the peanut butter, and it's got the honey in it. So how about, do you have any ideas for honey mustard or honey peanut butter chicken or anything?
Deborah, thanks a lot for the call. And Zeke, I'll let you know that we are the home in Wisconsin of the Mustard Museum, where we learned that there are tons of varieties of mustard, too. Have you worked on pairing varieties of honey with varieties of mustard?
In fact, I have, and there are a couple of recipes on my site. I have two. One is my buckwheat honey with a whole grain French style mustard, which is probably my favorite. And again, that big earthiness of the buckwheat honey, instead of things kind of getting sickly sweet, it really the tartness of the mustard with the earthiness of the buckwheat honey and the little bit of sweet really elevate it to something more than what you might make from that honey bear honey.
Well, and you could just experiment too. It sounds like get some mustard,
sure.
Get some honeys, and go to town.
Absolutely,
Deborah. Hope that helps. Thanks for that call. Rebecca is on the line next in Galesville. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. I'm hyperglycemic, so I can't eat any refined sugar, so I use honey quite frequently. My question is, I've heard several times, I'm not sure if it's fact or fiction, which I'm hoping you can help me with, whether or not there's a certain type of honey that is more sustainable than another.
More sustainable in terms of on the glycemic value or in terms
or do you mean
of
environmentally,
how it's produced
Rebecca?
Environmentally?
Environmentally produced, yes.
Okay. So environmentally polluted. So what's really important about choosing something that's environmentally sustainable in terms of honey is getting it from someone local or someone like myself who is working directly with the beekeepers. Most of the stuff that you're going to find in the grocery store is being imported from China, from Argentina, is blended together, so on and so forth. So not only are they significantly lower quality, they're often diluted with corn syrup to lower the price. So that's going to mess with your whole glycemic situation. So look, I'm always a fan of look for raw and definitely from within the United States.
Rebecca, thanks a lot for the call. So Zeke, say you're a honey newbie like me, and we want to get maybe three honeys on the rack, three different flavors. Sounds
yep.
like number one, I got to get some buckwheat. That's going to be job one because you mentioned that a lot. What are
yep.
a couple more that might be a good part to my on my spice rack?
I think orange blossom would be number two for me. It just has this big floral, slightly citrus notes to it and is very versatile. And then the second one is our sweet yellow clover. And the sweet yellow clover crystallizes very quickly in this very creamy, spreadable consistency and has these big notes of like cardamom and cinnamon. So those three like give you this big variation and you can really do a lot with them.
And Zeke, very briefly before I let you go, you're clearly a mad scientist in cooking with honey. What is your next experiment?
We actually have an ebook coming out in October for honey and cheese pairing. So if you're interested in that honey and cheese pairing, check out braw.com and download that ebook.
Zeke, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Zeke Freeman. He's a chef and founder and CEO of the honey company Bee Raw. He joins us to share sweet and savory honey-infused recipes for National Honey Month. You can find one of those recipes for candied honey bacon. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, hey, if you've got a recipe, share it. I may check it out. We just heard about pairing honey with cheese. Well, you know, this morning, Joy Cardine talked about cheese after six, the cheeses of Wisconsin. It was a lot of fun, but there was some fallout here in the offices. One of the cheeses she talked about was Limburger cheese, and someone actually brought in a good-sized chunk of a Wisconsin-made Limburger. I think maybe the only Wisconsin-made Limburger. Maybe the only American-made Limburger. I'm not sure. Of course, the thing that Limburger is famous for is the smell. And I can remember, maybe you remember, the cartoons. You know, there'd be Limburger, they'd unveil it, the smell waves come out, the characters pass out, overwhelmed by the strong, strong smell of Limburger. Well, Joy and her team, they share. They wanted to let everyone here at WPR have a chance to try a taste of the Limburger. So when I walked in this morning, the Limburger was just sitting out on a table in the hallway just outside of my office. And I will say, the cartoons were not wrong. That is one powerful smell. I did not pass out, I'm happy to say. But I do have to say the smell was so powerful, I gotta admit, I did not try it. If you are a lover of Limburger cheese, let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.